When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Now, before everybody falls asleep, and once they hear the title of today's episode, we want to assure you that this is not going to be full of a bunch of dry academic unsexy language. We're talking about something important. We're talking about something that is often misreported. And we're talking about something that, you know, can be a little misleading on the offset. So we thought, or at least I thought, a good way to get into this would be with a thought experiment. So imagine if one day, yours truly, me, your old pal Ben, and Josh Clark, friend of the show from Stuff You Should Know, imagine we are yet again beefing over some weird trivia point that no one except for, like, people like our crews would care about. You know, maybe it's domestication or some arcane little thing from a Brain Stuff video, and tensions are rising.
Well, first of all, Ben, if it results in an academic rumble, I hope you know that Matt and I have your back to the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I've called you channel. And I've said, hey, things are getting, you know, that that crazy dictator Josh Clark is going wild. This injustice will not stand. And you say, we've seen the public statements Josh and Ben are making. They're talking about how the other guy's a jerk and a pill, but we think nobody actually really wants an open conflict. A disagreement's okay. A rumble is maybe a bridge too far. So instead of coming into the office and attempting to physically smack me around, let's say Josh calls in some favors and suddenly no one in Atlanta will sell me a quesadilla. In fact, no one will even is allowed to sell me the ingredients to make a quesadilla. He hasn't launched a missile at me. He hasn't physically harmed me or any of the folks I roll with, but he's hit me where it hurts. He's affected my quality of life. This is a hopefully silly version of a very serious and dangerous thing, a concept called a sanction. So we have to hear the facts here. And yes, here are the facts. But this whole thing is kind of crazy, right? We've talked about it before. You see the public statements of various politicians or dictators or presidents, and what they talk about in an international sphere is way different from what they talk about in their domestic sphere when they want support. But one of the big secrets is most stable nations actually do not want continual large-scale hot wars. People don't want a World War III, or they definitely don't want to be seen as the kid on the playground who throws the first rock. You know what I mean? That's why it's always like, we're defending ourselves. We sent all these drones and thousands of troops to this country. Most Americans can't find on a map because we're defending ourselves. Oh, or we're fighting for human rights, whatever the thing is. Everybody wants to be seen as the good guy. No one wants to be thought of as the bad guy.
Well, you know, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter.
In my mind, that's why a well-executed false flag is so handy.
Mm-hmm. Gulf of Tonkin. Yes. Yes. You know, yeah, what?
For the win.
Right, right, right. You know, it's kind of a shame that, well, it's not a shame. The world's a better place because of this. But what kind of world would it be if we could do our own false flags? You know, people have tried that before. What was it? Jesse Smollett, most infamously recently. That's the actor who staged an assault, and his false flag was unsuccessful. He did get busted. But nations do want to make sure they can somehow make their aims and their desires known. And ideally, they want as many other nations to agree with them, and they like to posse up. But they also can't really trust each other. That's the thing. Countries are not friends. No matter what the people currently driving those things are saying, the concept of friendship doesn't make sense at this level. You can't really trust people. You can't trust institutions. So if you make a previous agreement, right, if it's something where like Matt and Noel and Mission Control and Doc and Scully and Ben are part of their own, we're part of our own agreement, and we made the great, you know, quesadilla accords, even amongst each other, we have to have a mechanism to enforce that agreement. Because otherwise, like, this is what you're talking about, I think, Noel, when you say, does something have teeth, right? Like, we were talking about this a little off air. Otherwise, it could be one of those non-binding resolutions, and people just ignore those. You're not going to send in troops. They're just going to say, hey, our understanding of that agreement was different. So fiddle-dee-dee, what you going to do, bro?
I mean, who decided to call them that? Non-binding agreements. It's like inherently not that scary. It's like, maybe we'll do it. Maybe we won't. See how we feel on the day.
It makes perfect sense, really. And it's just a public-facing release of a group's opinion on something, right? And it's just the first step. It's always the first step. If sanctions occur, there's almost always some kind of resolution that's put forward that's just like a, hey, here's how we feel about this. Just, it's a little heads up. there could be something else coming.
Mm-hmm. You have to have consequences. You have to have some kind of if-then equation going on. And ideally, you want to be able to either incentivize countries toward doing something you want them to do, even to the point of like pollution regulations, or you want to de-incentivize them from doing something else, right? So you don't want Libya or North Korea or South Africa to pursue nuclear armament. So you make these deals with them. And historically, I don't want to ruffle too many roost here, but historically, nations know that if they do back down from pursuing nuclear weaponry, things still aren't going to work out very well. I mean, there's a reason Gaddafi doesn't have a podcast now. You know, that's somewhat of a cold way to say it, but it's true. So you don't want war, but you want to get your way. So
here's where sanctions come in. There are a couple of broad types, and they're all used to one degree or another. And there's a lot of inequality in the world of sanctions, but they're also conspiratorial, because to be effective, they have to have a group that conspires, not just public entities, by the way, not just governments, but banks play a huge role in this. They get together and they conspire to change the actions of another nation, or in some cases, other groups of nations, or in some cases, even VIP, very high-powered individuals. If you are listening to this podcast, the odds are, and no offense to anyone, the odds are you're probably not a big enough deal to have the UN say, like, Paul, mission control has to be stopped. He can no longer control the dog toy market or something like that. You know, we're talking like Putin's at that level. And you know, at that point too, we'll get to this question in a second. You have to ask yourself, given how controversial the U.S. is, given how controversial past presidents and politicians here have been seen, you know, by people abroad, like how controversial their actions are, how come they don't have a bunch of sanctions? We'll tell you, but first we have to talk about the lay of the land. So, sanctioning a country, that's what most people have heard about. We're mad that Cuba is communist. Nobody sell them anything. We're not going to sell them anything, but if you hear this, you can't either, just because that's how we want it to be, or Syria or Iran.
Yeah, in the case with Cuba, the Soviet Union hears that and goes, oh, we'll gladly trade things mm-hmm. with you.
Exactly. That's part of the problem here. And then there are list-based sanctions. Like we talked about the HSBC drug cartel conspiracy and how that was a controversy because they were knowingly washing dirty money for organized crime. Well, they could have fallen under sanctions for that because if the EU, the US, or the UN had said, we're issuing a list-based sanction, you cannot do business with known drug cartels or terrorists or, you know, supervillains like Carlos the Jackal or whatever. I just keep saying that name because it's so cool. Those are a real thing. And essentially, like, if you look at it now, there's a way to target any group. You can move the lens however you wish. A vast majority of people alive aren't going to get specifically targeted by sanctions. But the scary part is you might be affected by them, even if you do not live in the country that has those sanctions imposed on them. And when we're hearing this thrown around, you know, obviously sanction has a couple of different meanings, right? Like, let's say Matt walks into the office one day and Noel and I are clearly heisting the little cooler where we keep all the fancy sodas and whatnot. And then you say, what is wrong with you guys? You're supposed to be company men. And then we tell you, our actions are sanctioned. The network said it was okay. That's a different kind of sanction, right?
These sodas are for everyone.
We're free. We are liberating these sodas. We got a flag and everything.
Yeah, you often hear like the hyphenate of that, like government sanctioned whatever, terrorism even, right? Like you heard, sometimes that term is used as like a ding on the government, where maybe it's not officially sanctioned, but you can call some negative behavior something sanctioned, government sanctioned, to imply that there was approval given, that this was like, there was co-signed by the highest level of authority.
Government sanctioned burning of rice patties.
Yeah, or books.
Mm-hmm. And so when you hear this term thrown around, what you're going to hear, what they're referring to really, the full name is like international sanctions. That's the state level stuff. Even though there are a lot of people in the world who wish that they could impose their own sanctions, the best you can do in you know, your life as a private individual is going to be to attempt to create a boycott, right? And get a bunch of other people to agree with you and say, hey, we're not gonna support tours in Miami, Florida because of something Miami did. And if you get enough people to agree with you, then that's kind of like a sanction, but it's way less powerful. I think we should talk about like the different categories of what we're looking at here, because they're not all created equally. Some are more dangerous than others, but they all have some punch. One of them especially is very, I think, topical now, and it's surprisingly effective, but not in a way that says impressive things about humanity.
Well, let's start off with ye olde financial sanction, or an economic sanction. This is probably the most common one you've heard about, certainly recently over the past 10, 20 years. It's the concept. We are agreeing to not sell this country / this ruler anything, and or very specific things, and or we're not going to buy any goods of a specific type from this country, or you're not allowed to, basically. And then again, like in the case of Iran, there's a sanction that says no one can buy iron or steel from Iran. And then, you know, private companies out of another country like China say, we'll gladly take that steel at a very low price.
Because we're the only buyers.
Yeah, exactly. And if you take it back to the cheese example, the quesadilla example that we set up earlier, it'd be the concept of not only can no one sell, let's say, Ben quesadillas, no one can even sell him cheese. No one can sell him pork. I don't know, beef. What do you put in your quesadillas, Ben?
Well, at this point, damn near anything I could get my hands on. It's terrible. Life has changed.
No tortillas. No tortillas for you.
This will not stand. I'm radicalized. No, you're right. And this sounds like a silly example again, but consider it in the realm of nuclear research, because so much nuclear equipment is dual use, meaning the same things that can build peaceful nuclear power plants can be used to build nuclear weapons. So banning a quesadilla purchase is saying nobody can sell intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, to Iran. That would be one example. But going further and saying, you know, you can't buy the ingredients, you can't buy the cheese and the tortillas and the, you know, the mushrooms, what have you. That's like a one-to-one comparison with saying not only can you not buy missiles, but you can't buy the stuff that would be used to assemble missiles. You can't buy the plutonium that could be refined, or the uranium that could be refined. You can't buy the centrifuges. And we don't believe anything you're saying about peaceful nuclear power. So that's all that's going to happen. Typically, these sanctions, mainly for humanitarian and PR purposes, they'll have some exemptions. And they'll say, like, okay, you can't trade anything except necessities for ordinary people. So you can buy food or medicine, right, from international producers of those things. Stuff like insulin, right?
Right. I mean, this is one that can really hurt, you know? We were talking a little bit about this off air, and I was sort of saying how, like, you know, a blockade, you know, for example, of goods and services from one country to another isn't the same as like an invasion. It's not a hot war. It's like us staying on our turf and just saying, nope, you can't come through, or you can't get stuff from us. But those things matter if you're like the number one producer of said good, and it results in people maybe getting sick or not getting the things they need for basic survival.
And they're enforced, by the way. We should also say this. One of the things that makes them binding is violation of sanctions is considered a crime. And it doesn't matter if everybody agrees to the sanction. The U.S. does a lot of what are called unilateral sanctions, which is just Uncle Sam saying, I don't like them. You shouldn't like them either. And if you are a business that's based in this country, then it's illegal for you to mess with them. Even if that was the entirety of your business before, we will put you under the jail and we'll put you in the poorhouse. We don't care. And they usually, because the global West controls the banking system, or the vast majority of what we call the, you know, the anatomy of the banking system across the world, they can really, really make an impact there. And these things can be tremendously damaging. Usually before you get to like a big catastrophic economic sanction, you've got a diplomatic sanction. And the best way to explain a diplomatic sanction is, we're mad at you. We're closing down our clubhouse. We're not staying at the slumber party. We're going back to mom's. So that's like, we're closing the embassy. We're not taking your calls. We're not going to meetings with you until you apologize. And because this is stuff they don't want you to know, we're pretty open about this. When we're talking about diplomacy, we're also talking about spies. We're also talking about assets and tradecraft and the intelligence community, because not every IT director or not every IT grunt at your local embassy is necessarily actually an IT guy.
Yeah. Well, and the United States has a specific department that we're going to get into when we talk about the history here within the Department of Treasury called the OFAC or the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And a major part of their mission is to gather intelligence on countries and individuals who have sanctions placed against them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're the enforcers of this. And you won't hear a ton about them when you hear sanctions mentioned on, say, your CNN or whatever your news channel of choice is. They don't get talked a lot about. They're not super sexy, but they're not super secret. You know, they're just the people who have to enforce the at times grandiose statements and declarations of politicians, whether they are made in good faith or bad faith. There are also military sanctions. Wait, you might be saying, how is a military sanction not a war? You don't have to declare war to have a military sanction. That's a targeted strike, right? That's like a UAV taking out a factory. Factories are a great example of this. Attacking manufacturing infrastructure, you will just have country A saying, we know you're up to something at that factory, so we took it off the table. Now you apologize for making us do that to you. That's kind of how it goes. And it should be no surprise.
Ouch.
Yeah, it does, it's tough to figure out. We'll talk about whether that situation would be considered successful later. But so we've got military, diplomatic, economic. Here's the one that surprises me. It's a real thing. Sports sanctions. You have probably heard stories about this where, like, person from insert country here is not allowed to play at the Olympics because their country got in trouble. It has nothing to do with, you know, chess or volleyball or what have you. This is a soft power push. You're not allowing a given country's athletes, teams, or individuals to compete internationally. And it sounds kind of absurd that this would matter, but this one does actually work because people are by and large the same across the planet. They hate it when their favorite sports teams don't get a chance to win something. So, like, if the economic pressure is not pushing a dictator out of a place of power, then not letting the national soccer team compete in the Olympics or, the, God forbid, the World Cup, that might push the needle. People might say, okay, I was all right with a lot of injustices, but you touched the football, Your Excellency. Mm. And that's a line too far. That can actually work. Why does that work?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's a hit to pride, I think, and nationalism. If you think back to they were sanctions put on Russia during the Olympics, but it wasn't exactly the kind we're discussing here, but very similar because of the anti-doping movement and some of the mechanisms there, both within the Russian Federation and the Olympics Committee. Where I can't remember fully, you guys, but I remember in the last Summer Olympics, or maybe it was two Olympics ago, many Russian athletes were not allowed to compete. And if they were allowed to compete, they weren't allowed to, like, have a medal ceremony if they won. Something very similar happened with that with the Winter Olympics. It just happened in the Winter Olympics. Oh, man, I'm blanking on it. There was a skater who was... It was decided she was allowed to compete, but if she won a medal, there would be no official ceremony.
Bummer. I mean, that's kind of the thing that every, you know, young Olympian dreams of, is like standing on that podium and getting handed that medal.
That skater's name, if you look it up, is Kamila Valieva, Valieva.
It's a soft power thing. Soft power is weird. And it works. Don't let the name soft fool you. It is measurable.
Well, it's an optics thing. It's about humiliation, kind of, in a way.
Mm-hmm. And it's a war of perception, too. Also, a lot of times the proposed ideas for sanctions are not the entire story. Let's be very clear about that. Like, if you look at if you look at some, especially during the Cold War, if you look at some of these things, what they're proposing and the full extent of their calculus are often not announced together. You have to do digging to figure out what's happening. The new kid on the block here is environmental sanctions. The idea is you can put up trade barriers, the restrictions to stop poaching, to stop pollution, and so on. Honestly, the jury is still out on whether this works. But the logic's there. Hitting someone in the wallet has definitely made a difference in the past. You always hear that phrase when people talk about sanctions. It's hitting someone in the wallet. And I can't help but think of "I Think You Should Leave Now," where the guy is like, "You hit me in the cup." Do you remember that?
Yeah.
You got to give.
Yes.
A lot of people give.
Yeah. Otherwise, it'll go dark.
Right. Okay. You know what? I hope if anyone hasn't seen that show or that episode, I hope you think we're just having a weird freestyle conversation.
Just do yourself a favor and check it out. The episodes are like 18 minutes or something crazy like that. You will know very quickly whether it's your thing or not, but I hope it is.
You hit me in the cup. Anyway, so those are like, that's kind of the bare bones, the different flavors in the Baskin Robbins of international sanctions. Sanctions also, they take international cooperation to really be effective. The UN certainly thinks about them a lot. One country alone can lead a sanction initiative, but they're going to have a hard time meeting their own goals. And yes, that includes the big dogs, the Chinas, the Russias, the USs. And that's because in many cases, if one country won't sell you something, like you were pointing out earlier, Matt, somebody else will. The US is a huge fan of unilateral sanctions. They have regrettable personal experience with this conundrum. And that wasn't always the case, because while sanctions sound like a modern day thing, back in the eras of yore, you could totally sanction the crap out of someone on your own. There's a journalist, Uri Friedman, who's writing in Foreign Policy, and he points this out. He says, quote, "As a blunt tool of diplomacy, the concept of sanctions has been around at least from the time of the ancient Greeks, when Athens imposed a trade embargo on its neighbor Megara in 432 BCE. So they are very old. And Noel, like you had mentioned, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, the old school sanctions were physical shutdowns, right? We're building a wall around all your stuff. Now do what we say.
And that was a bit different in 432 BCE, where you could literally just send troops and block off some roads, kind of like what was happening in Ottawa and other places in the world with the trucks. But you just do it with soldiers. And there's like only a few trade routes.
A phalanx? How do you pronounce that word? Like where they literally line up with shields and create a human wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could do that. And to your point, Matt, these things were happening before there were global trade and communication networks anywhere near what exists today. So Megara wouldn't have had the option to, and pardon my Greek pronunciation, folks, but it wouldn't have had the option to, say, contact some equivalent of the UN and say, they're starving our people. This is collective punishment. This is a siege, you know, that is, in our opinion, dirty politics or dirty diplomacy. Those outlets didn't exist. That's why for a long time, countries would just send a bunch of troops or ships, just physically shut it down. We control the bay. So good luck getting a ship out. You know what I mean? And naval blockades were a huge part of the dominance of European empires in the age of expansion there. But as you fast forward, you see like through the centuries, sanctions have become more and more sophisticated. They become more and more surgically targeted. They've become more and more embedded in the world of international finance, but they are still a far cry from perfect, like a far cry 6 from perfect. In fact, a growing number of experts are convinced that sanctions don't actually work at all. So What does that mean? Why this is a huge industry, by the way, sanctioning. But Why did they come to that conclusion? We're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, Sanctions Are Us, and then we're going to dive into the answer.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah. Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Here's where it gets crazy. Let's go back to that earlier example. One of the first historically proven records of a sanction. Athens tries to shut down its neighbor. Did it work? No. It started the Peloponnesian War.
Dang, that's exactly what we wanted to avoid.
I know. It's like, I can't believe my elaborate system of open flames and oily rags keeps burning down houses. I guess I'll try again.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things, too, where you push people, you know? And what do? They push back eventually. Even if you're not actually setting foot on their territory, they are eventually going to react.
Well, I mean, threaten someone's livelihood. Or, you know, an entire nation's livelihood and ability to
the food
make
on their
money.
Table.
Yeah, those are fighting actions.
Right, right.
Fighting like sanctions.
Right, there it is. It's like we were talking about with direct action eco-terrorism, right, is the word that gets thrown around. The people on the whaling ship aren't gonna be like, all these things you've done to us. No, you know, you made a good point. They're going to want retribution. They're going to push back. Humans are relatively Newtonian in that regard. So this is not to say the sanctions don't have potential. They just have a lot of serious problems that need to be considered. First, if you look at those unilateral sanctions, one powerful country says no. And that's basically it. One powerful country says no. Does it work? This is something I found this interesting. I wanted to share it with all our fellow listeners. Have you guys heard of the Cato Institute?
Cato Kalin? The neighbor?
No, but that would be way more interesting.
Cato. I have not, unfortunately. Cato from the Green Hornet?
No, but also even more interesting than the first one, yeah. No, unfortunately, it's none of those things. The Cato Institute is a think tank that does have its own agenda, but it's a think tank that raises some really good points about the dangers of these unilateral sanctions. Like the, you know, again, the most famous one here in the West is the U.S. embargo against the neighboring nation of Cuba. Not real. I mean, it's politically dirty. It's not as if Cuba attacked the U.S. It's because they didn't want the country to be communist. And that's why they made life just terrible for a bunch of people who didn't really get to decide what kind of government they would live in. They were just born. And when they were born, no one asked them, like, hey, you're a couple days old. What's your take on you know, the nature of governance? No, and nobody asked them when they were 20. Nobody asked them when they were 30. Nobody's going to ask them on their deathbed. But they have to bear the brunt of these consequences. So, like, I just pulled a few excerpts here, but would love to go through these and then get everybody's take on whether or not you agree or disagree. And then we'll also shed some light on Cato Institute, too. But we'll save that to the end.
Here we go. Quote, unilateral sanctions simply do not work. There are no examples of U.S. unilateral economic sanctions changing the basic character or significant policies of a foreign nation. The 35-year economic embargo of Cuba, a tiny country less than 90 miles from the U.S. coast, is a monument to the ineffectiveness of unilateral economic sanctions as a foreign policy tool. To the point that you were making earlier, Matt, I mean, if anything, it's just going to cause further simmering resentment that could explode.
Yeah. And depending on which nation or group comes to the aid of the person undergoing sanctions or having sanctions imposed on them, it could become a much bigger problem with multiple people or nations or, you know, however you want to put it, involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they're saying here, and there are statistics from other sources to back this up, if you don't like the Cato Institute, what they're saying here is if you measure the goals of the people instituting the sanctions, in this case, the U.S., and then you measure, you know, the cost of that sanction, you measure, you know, whatever metric you want for these regimes, because a sanction is a regime. It's a set of rules and governing policies. If you measure that stuff, it's a bill of goods. It's not doing what people wanted it to do. And the question is that because it's being misused or it needs to be fixed? Or is that because we're trying to fix the problem with the wrong tool? Like a kitchen whisk is useful, but it's not going to help you get a nail into a 2x4. That's what hammers are for. So that's like a very, I think, for my sake, that's a very dumbed down comparison, but that is part of the question. What they're saying here is that the idea of a one entity sanction is just a non-starter. And they also have a little bit of a hit piece, or not a little. This is like the equivalent of a diss track or a diss line in a hip hop song in the academic sense, because they also, as we'll find, accuse the U.S. for giving itself undeserved attaboys for sanctions that it will tell you did work out.
And not to mention that they also, the Institute rejects the idea that unilateral sanctions against apartheid South Africa worked. They wrote on that subject, quote, supporters of sanctions often point to South Africa as a success story, but the facts tell a different tale. It is unrealistic to credit the U.S. congressional vote for sanctions in October 1986 with the overthrow of apartheid. It was not outside forces, but powerful and well-organized domestic political forces that, after a three-decade-long struggle, achieved the peaceful overthrow of an anachronistic system that had no moral standing. Wait a minute. So you're saying the U.S. claimed responsibility for something someone else did, trying to steal the thunder of someone else's hard work? I don't believe that would ever happen.
Exactly. They're saying, okay, pump your brakes, Uncle Sam. I know it all felt great inside the Beltway, inside the halls of power in D.C., when you could pat each other on the back and say, we did it. We made the world a better place in South Africa because we made it too expensive to continue being monstrous. But that is clearly dismissing the multi-generational, multi-decade-long efforts of people who live in the area to make the world better for themselves. That is, you know, put in that light, that does seem very dismissive. It's got some shades of white savior complex or whatever you want to call it. But it is also politically convenient for the powers that be to say, we did this.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody responsible for those kinds of claims, it truly ideologically believes that that's the truth.
Yeah, well.
Do you?
There are always a few. There are always a few people who, like, folks are really good at rationalization, very cognitively agile and nimble. So there are a few people who have convinced themselves in retrospect that yes. And there are people who say, you know, maybe our sanction regime was not the entire reason that apartheid went away, but we played the right role. We did the right thing. And I think you can say that, right? You just can't dismiss the efforts of the people who actually live there and all the work that they did to push for a better society. So here's where the Cato bias comes in. You might have been persuaded while you heard this, and you might have thought, those are good points. Maybe sanctions don't work. The thing you got to know about Cato Institute is, yes, it's a think tank. It's a libertarian think tank. And that's not to say that their points are invalid. I think they're raising very good points. But if you do some digging, there's a website we love here called SourceWatch. And if you go to SourceWatch, it's like a Wikipedia that just tells you the associations, the aims, the missions of various groups and nonprofits and what have yous. So it's very valuable today when a lot of bad faith actors will try to sell you something under a misleading name. So Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank, and as such, they are always going to be suspicious of any high-level government involvement in any aspect of commerce. They're like, hey, you should just let people sell and buy stuff. You know what I mean? That's where we're coming through. They make good points, but also you have to realize that in general, their stance is going to be against anything they see as excessive regulation. They think the spice must flow and everything is the spice, with the possible exception of nuclear weapons. Not even then all the time. So in the opinion of them and some more conservative, like traditionally conservative forces, the real victim of unilateral sanctions on the part of the U.S., it's not the governments of those countries. It's not even really the people who live in those countries. It's the U.S.-based businesses who, get this, are losing money. Won't someone think of the corporations? Yeah,
they hate that.
I want a Sarah McLachlan where it's her talking about saving the corporations, you know?
I always bring this Mr. Show quote up, but it's like the movie executives saying, I swear to God, if I have to go from being super rich to just rich, I'm going to kill myself.
Hey, just in thinking about another source in this kind of exactly what we're saying, the efficacy of sanctions. I want to read a quick quote, if I may, that I found in this. It's from the United States Institute of Peace. I'm just going to read this to you guys. According to a gentleman named Robert Art, his research on applications of coercive diplomacy, which is sanctions are a type of coercive diplomacy, by U.S. policymakers over the past 12 years has shown that, quote, coercive diplomacy fails more often than it succeeds, and they are estimating that coercive diplomacy techniques have been roughly successful around 20% of the time. This is one opinion from, you know, some group that studied 12 years of these kinds of things like sanctions, and they're saying 20% of the time it's effective.
Right. You can find other statistics as well that say, like, if we'll get to this, like how you measure the so-called effectiveness. You'll see other statistics that say over the length of time, this has a relatively negligible effect on economies, right, in many, many cases. It's not always the case, right? Because 20% is not zero, but 20% is not even, is definitely not a B+. It's not even a passing grade. No. That's the kind of stuff that gets you held back in school. So this is clearly a case of asking about the motivations of the people making the sanctions. Again, the game is already rigged because you have to be a powerful nation or you have to be part of a powerful international bloc of nations, like a group of people at the UN or the European Union. You have to be at that level to enforce sanctions, to make them real things other than just like an official, we hate this country meeting, right? So with what we know about the conversation now, can we say that sanctions are worth it? We'll tackle that after a word from our sponsor, who is hopefully a seller of miniature false flags. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Set sail and save right away when you book your next Disney cruise vacation with UndercoverTourist.com. Undercover Tourist is your secret for savings on all Disney Resorts vacations. And now, fun in the sun with Disney Cruise Lines. How about enchanting entertainment or an exclusive visit to Castaway Key? Anything's possible aboard a Disney cruise vacation. Book now with UndercoverTourist.com, an authorized seller, and get a free in-room decor package with your Disney Cruise Line booking. Plus, exclusive savings at checkout. UndercoverTourist.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com. Where America goes to hire.
We're back. All right. Look, at best, we can call the efficacy of sanctions, the degree to which they work, debatable. And that's not because it's at heart a terrible idea. It's because it's very difficult to measure their level of success. First, you have to define their level of success, and that can be tricky on its own. I want to introduce the director of the Masters in International Security degree program, as well as the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, one Ellen Lapson, who says, look, if we're just going to summarize. She says, look, if it's your intention to punish a country, then just measuring the economic pain you've inflicted on that country, yeah, that's a way of saying it worked, right? Like, we tanked the economy. Therefore, success. Go team. Let's get on another naval vessel and have a big ass sign that says mission accomplished. Let's get that photo op.
Yeah. Yeah, those are
don't
cool.
Do it. It doesn't work out. It doesn't work out historically. Like, history judges that kind of action very, very poorly.
Well, Ben, I was going to ask you, like, so, I mean, obviously many things are ideological in government in terms of, like, this is going to be our thing, either as a party or as a candidate or as a, you know, an elected official. Would you say that sanctions or the idea of kind of carrots and sticks is one of those? Where it's like there's some people that just believe in it all in, like, this is the way, and we're going to, you know, work our diplomatic magic and affect change across the world with this brilliant series of sanctions. And then there are some maybe that don't lean into it as hard and think what you're saying, that maybe it's debatable.
I think whether they were. Yeah, I think it's you raise a really interesting point. So across the history of the U.S., political parties, members of any political party, have been for sanctions in the past, unless they're absolute isolationist, which is incredibly rare these days. But what we do see is that when sanctions are politically convenient, they get support. So if you are a politician who is seeing a lot of good polling numbers every time you say, I hate Russia or I hate China, and I'm very hawkish on those two countries or something, then of course you're going to reply. You're going to give your audience what they want, because they're not going to ask you hard policy questions. And you can always defer, because you're only really going to be talking on the news for like, what, a couple minutes at a time, unless you really screw up. So you don't have to explain your actual calculus. All you have to do is respond, is create the feedback loop of what people want. That is the nature of politics. It's one of the broken things about that system. But you're right. So it happens case by case when convenient for domestic powers, or when they feel like there is an existential threat to global security or, you know, to the U.S. So they would say, hey, we've all had our differences, but Iran just cannot have a nuclear bomb, right? We can agree on that, right? And then like the very far right people are like, we should have the most nukes, right? And the far left people are like, well, I would like for there not to be any nukes, but we can agree that Iran shouldn't have any. And they're like, all right, deal. We'll team up for this one. That's how that kind of stuff happens. And
there's similar teaming up against groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL, ISIS, and those where sanctions
are pretty
much universally agreed.
Yes, because no one wants to risk political suicide by saying, hold on, right? Like, I know terrorists are bad, but I think these sanctions are an overreach, because that first line wouldn't make it into the news. You would be the person where it's like, you know, Senator Scully Brownstone or whatever comes out in support of ISIS. That's what people would remember. They wouldn't think you had some nuanced standing on policy and philosophy of market forces. Even if you did, even if like your degree was in that, it wouldn't matter. So yeah, people aren't going to do that. But what if we try to measure success not by the financial pain inflicted on innocent people in a country and the country's rulers, maybe. But what if we tried to measure it by seeing the change in the country's behavior? Did the country begin to do the stuff you wanted to push them into doing or tempt them into doing? Did you carrot them right with like an aid package? See, that's the nice side of sanctions, right? The kind of stuff like that, aid package, technical assistance, support, logistics, that kind of stuff. You can give actors things too. But if you try to measure the degree of change in behavior, you have to use a way different metric. And in that case, by that definition, which is the actual definition you should be using, right? By that definition, most sanctions clearly fail, because countries like people become resistant. They'll be willing to absorb pain for the reasons of pride, for nationalism. They don't want to concede to this bigger country that is very easily seen as a bully, and often with good reason. They imagine, even if they're not thinking of it in these trope terms, they imagine a David versus Goliath situation. You know what I mean? Just because my country is smaller than yours does not give you the right to act as though you rule us. And that's a good point as well. You know, like you said, U.S. leaned hard on Cuba. The USSR was waiting with open arms. They said, we get you. Not only do we get you, this is like, this is one of the petty things. I love the petty details. They were like, not only do we get you, not only we have your back, bro, but we're going to, all that sugar you can't sell, we're going to buy it and we're going to purposely overpay for it. So five times what you're supposed to pay for a kilo, that's you. Take it. Go do something nice. Do something good for yourself. Do you like missiles? We get a lot of missiles. I'm going to send you some missiles, okay? Don't worry about this. And they were doing that to support the country, but they were also inevitably on some level doing it because they knew it would piss off the U.S. It was a flex.
Yeah. Well, they also knew it would kind of scare the U.S. I'm just bringing this back to foreign policy that's occurring right now as we're recording this because of the proximity to the United States, where the USSR was operating. And very similarly to where there are major issues in Ukraine right now, I would posit, and I'm no expert here, because of the proximity to the Russian Federation or to Russia.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately what you want is hegemony. You want to go from being a regional power to ultimately being a global power. So that's where you get into the concept of vassal states or client states, I believe, would be the proper terminology because nobody likes to bring up the concept of serfdom and vassalhood, even when it is very appropriate. Anyway, you want de facto in practice sovereignty over neighboring countries. You want to have the most influence, right? And you also ideally don't want to have the responsibility and accountability you would have if they were really part of your country. You know what I mean? So the idea is it's a devil's bargain. Do what we say. We'll protect you from the wolves across the way. Though we are in this case also a wolf.
Well, just as another quick example there, Ben, I keep thinking about North Korea and just how gloriously unsuccessful sanctions against North Korea have been at getting the, quote, hermit state to change its oppositional stance to countries around it. I mean, how many missile tests has that country done in the past 10 years? And sanctions have been on them, what? Gosh. I mean, the main ones I'm thinking about happened in the mid-90s, and they're still like, I don't know. It almost hardened their position, I would say.
It just occurred to me the hermit state, I guess, refers to the fact that they don't ever really leave the house, you know, or at least the global house.
Yeah, yeah. And also, that's a really interesting cut. Of course, I'm going to say that. Don't feel like that has to be part of a drinking game. Because you'll drink too much. But geopolitically, it's really interesting because out of all the countries in the region and in other countries involved in things like the six-party talks, like the U.S., they don't really want the peninsula to reunite. China doesn't really want South Korea or a democratic South Korea right on its border like that. It's already close enough. And you know, of course, the families have been ripped apart by the Korean War. And there's beautiful moments when people on different sides of the borders can reunite after decades. And both the Republic of Korea and the DPRK do publicly state they would love to reunify the peninsula. But they each think their government should be in charge when that reunification occurs. And the power, like the global superpowers, aren't particularly pressuring this country, North Korea, to open up ultimately. Because before Russian power really started deteriorating, they were a powerful ally of DPRK. And also, nobody talks about this, but for a while, average quality of life in DPRK was better than it was in the Republic of Korea. That's very much not the case now. But anyway, yes, what I'm saying is your example holds. The backyard reasoning is real here, and it's very much a NIMBY situation, not in my backyard, say world powers.
I love that movie, The Secret of NIMBY.
Yes, I like it too. I was going to have a movie night and put it on a big projector outside, just not in my backyard, maybe one of yours.
No joke, though. The Secret of NIMBY is one of my favorite animated movies of all time.
It's good.
It's very sad.
It's good.
But it is beautiful. I watched it with my kid when she was like maybe 7 or 8, and I cry at Pixar movies, to be fair, but I cried a lot as an adult watching The Secret of NIMBY.
So that reminds me of one of the biggest points we have to talk about today. And so one of the last points of this episode, unintended consequences. I wanted to see this movie. I didn't know it would turn on the wetworks, or as our good pal Chandler Mays says, send the onion ninjas to my house, which took me forever to understand that. Like, I feel like you walked down the street to make that reference.
Oh my God, you sure did, but it's quite brilliant. You know what? Secret of NIMBY is also about unintended consequences of progress. Mm-hmm. And
so the unintended consequences here are not super smart rodents, spoiler alert, but I didn't ruin it for you. It's about this, like,
it's on the back cover.
Yeah, it's in the blurb. Picture this. Let's say you are targeting a country that is ruled by an authoritarian, oppressive regime, and you're targeting them because you want them to quit their human rights abuses. You want them to stop threatening adjacent countries and becoming bellicose and pushing for war or annexing places or, you know, stealing resources or aiding and abetting terrorism. You name it, all the hits, all the good ones. And then you say, okay, we're going to hit them with a massive economic sanction. And the goal of this is, we are going to make their current actions so increasingly expensive, so cost prohibitive, that it will be to their financial advantage to start creating first a less aggressive government and then a more democratic government. And those things never happen in a vacuum. There are a lot of other levers they could pull with that now, but that's the basic. Well, here's the problem. The vast majority of that population, they're living in an authoritarian or corrupt regime. They have no say in politics, just like we were pointing out in like a Cuban situation. They don't really have a say. They will be first in line to suffer the consequences of this stuff. And the people in power, the people you're trying to intimidate or squeeze or smack with the political stick a little bit, they're like the only folks in those countries who have the connections and influence to soften the blow and still get what they want. Oh, I can't officially get that McLaren or that giant whale skeleton that I wanted for my second mansion. I'll just call my other dictator buddy.
You don't want those things. That's a lot of responsibility.
He's got someone for that. He's got whale skeleton people already. He walks by and looks at it. Shout out again to Putin's mansion in the interior of that. But what will happen then is they have the opportunity and the wherewithal to use proxy companies, right? To have other forces, third parties get around those sanctions. And it happens all the time, whenever it's advantageous for that third party to help someone. So what this means is this sanction could accidentally and quickly become widespread collective punishment inflicted on people whose lives weren't already super great to begin with. Part of the UN itself, who's big in the sanctions game, agrees with this. Even they play a huge role in the imposition of sanctions. And as recently as 2021, they found that unilateral sanctions in particular, which was very a cough, cough, US cough, cough statement, they said those in particular cause innocent people living in those countries to sink into poverty. They can't get electricity, housing, water, gas, fuel, basic stuff. And what is that going to do? Are they going to be like, I am suffering because this country I have never visited is right about this country in which I was born? You know,
not to mention they don't let you get your gold medal.
You don't get the gold medal, right? You don't get the medicine. You don't get the food.
Can I just point out quickly a source that we found for this It actually comes from the UN itself. It's news.un.org. And the title of this article is "Punishment of, quote, innocent civilians through government sanctions must end," according to UN experts.
I mean, wouldn't that fall under collateral damage? I mean, these aren't bombs, but they have unintended consequences, which is what collateral casualties surrounding targeted, you know, military
that's
assaults.
That's part of the...
It's not,
yeah,
not
that's part of the logic. I do want to point out that report came from a group of independent experts who were appointed by the Human Rights Council, which is its own bag of badgers. And, you know, there are many, many arguments out there about the overall accuracy of the Human Rights Council and whether it might be rigged, because there have been member states on the Human Rights Council in the past who have just astonishingly bad domestic human rights records. Anyway, so there are going to be people who say it's a poison source, but those were independent experts, and they did say to the people who make a lot of sanctions, hey, sanctions are bad. We get what you're going for, but it's bad. And if we go to like what you're bringing up, Noel, on the other side of sort of the octopus here, people imposing sanctions, no, they're not perfect, but they believe they're making a call in favor of the greater good. The calculus is like, okay, is it better for us to run the risk of making lives of innocent people measurably worse if it means we can prevent a dangerous government from getting and deploying like an atomic bomb? You know what I mean? Is life going to be less cool for some people so that other people can survive? Or should we just let those ponies ride? You know what I mean? Let those ponies run. It's tough, man. It's a tough question, because the question would be a lot easier to answer if the effects of sanctions were easier to predict. But these days, so many countries, especially the U.S., the overall global West, are convinced that these actions are necessary for continued global peace and security, or, for being cynical, to continue a profitable status quo, right? Like the shadow of colonialism looms large. There's a reason that the West has taken so many actions in the Middle East and so many actions on the African continent. And it's not to help the people who live there.
Resources.
Yes. Yeah. So at this point, it's reasonable to ask, why are you talking about this on stuff they don't want you to know, guys? Well, it's a problem of transparency. It's a problem of consent. The innocent people most likely to be victimized by sanctions are, in theory, some of the same people those sanctions are supposed to help. They don't get a say in international affairs. They don't get to talk in Congress. They don't get to speak to the UN. In fact, I was thinking about this. In fact, these harsh economic conditions, you know, these empty grocery stores, the inability to get a job, all of that kind of stuff, all that fallout, these things can often be directly traced to sanctions, and they can run the risk of radicalizing the population, bolstering support for the same regimes the sanction seeks to topple. So it's a way of adding fuel to the fire, and it seems such a transparent problem in logic here that it must be impossible for at least some of the people imposing sanctions not to know this, which calls their motivations for the sanctions themselves into question. Is that too much of a stretch?
No, I don't think so at all. I'm actually really glad we're talking about this, Ben, because sanctions are in the news prominently right now with regards to Russia and, you know, some actions that the United States and the UN may or may not be taking against Russia because of their actions with regards to Ukraine. And I'm just glad we've got a better understanding of it, though it does feel like it may not be the best move. Because if you don't want to radicalize someone further, you don't want to cause further tensions, it seems like sanctioning someone is maybe a bad idea.
And it can also, I mean, if you push a government to a desperate place, it starts considering other options, right? Like whenever you have any
and we don't like those options.
Entity cornered. Yeah. Well, and honestly, not a lot of people do. So you're right when we talk about this. Look, we don't have the answers. These can be dangerous situations. The right level of economic sanctions can absolutely just wreck a country. And that means it'll be very dangerous for the people who live in that country. When elephants make war, it is the grass that suffers, and so on. So with this, we want to leave it to you. What do you think? Sanctions. Are you for them? Are you against them? Are they worth it? Do they work? What would be the alternative? Oh, they're coming.
That's the alternative.
I guess we're keeping that one in. The streets are hot, folks. We hope things are going well in your neck of the global woods, and we can't wait to hear your take. We try to be easy to find online.
Find us online, indeed. We exist under the handle at Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, at Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Or why not give us a telephone call? Matt, how can they do that thing?
They call 1-833-STDWYTK. That's just stuff they don't want you to know in acronym form. Call that number. Give yourself a cool nickname. We would appreciate it. Make us laugh if you can. Bonus points all around, always with this show, if you can make us all collectively laugh. Say whatever you want. We love suggestions for new episodes. We love comments on other previous episodes. Really anything, though, we take it. Stories are probably my favorite. Just an encapsulated 3-minute story. If you've got more to say than can fit in that 3 minutes, instead consider sending us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox